that question of what we're actually measuring versus what we think we're measuring runs directly into the semaglutide research, which is one of the two health stories today that deserves serious attention. A new study published in Alzheimer's and Dementia, the Journal of the Alzheimer's Association, found that semaglutide use is associated with a meaningfully lower predicted dementia risk. 439 points, 308 comments, and the community response is a mix of genuine scientific excitement and warranted methodological caution.
Let's be precise about what the study is and isn't saying, because this matters a lot. The finding is associational. People taking semaglutide showed lower predicted dementia risk based on established biomarkers and risk models. This is not a randomized controlled trial showing that semaglutide prevents dementia. The mechanism is genuinely unclear, though there are several plausible hypotheses. GLP-1 receptors are expressed in the brain. Metabolic health improvements reduce cardiovascular risk factors that contribute to vascular dementia, and there may be direct neuroprotective effects through inflammatory pathways.
The HN comment thread is doing exactly what I'd hope it would, stress testing the methodology. The biggest concern being raised is healthy user bias. People who are prescribed and consistently take semaglutide may simply be more engaged with their health broadly, have better healthcare access, and make other lifestyle choices that reduce dementia risk. Separating the drug's effect from the effects of being the kind of person who's prescribed it and takes it consistently is genuinely hard in observational data.
That said, the biological plausibility is real enough that several commenters with neuroscience backgrounds are calling for accelerated RCT investment. Given the scale of the dementia epidemic, roughly 55 million people living with dementia globally as of 2024, with projections reaching 78 million by 2030, even a partial protective effect from a drug that's already widely prescribed would be a substantial public health outcome.
The second health story is about abdominal fat as a predictor of heart disease risk. The American College of Cardiology data showing that visceral adiposity, fat around the organs in the abdominal cavity, outperforms BMI as a cardiovascular risk predictor got 271 points and 208 comments. This is not a shock to anyone who's been following the obesity medicine literature, but having it stated clearly in ACC press materials matters for clinical practice.
The BMI debate in the comments is lively, as it always is. BMI has the advantage of being cheap and easy to measure. Waist circumference, which correlates well with visceral adiposity, is nearly as cheap and easy, but hasn't been standardized into clinical workflows the same way. The argument being made by several commenters with clinical backgrounds is that this data should push health systems toward waist-to-height ratio as a standard vital sign alongside BMI, not as a replacement, but as a complement.
The metabolic mechanism is worth explaining briefly. Visceral fat is metabolically active in a way that subcutaneous fat, the fat under the skin, is not. It secretes inflammatory cytokines, contributes to insulin resistance, and is anatomically positioned to drain directly into the portal circulation to the liver. Two people with identical BMIs can have radically different cardiovascular risk profiles depending on where their fat is distributed. The data on this has been accumulating for a decade, but clinical practice changes slowly.
And then there's the material science story that I want to make sure we cover properly, because the HN score, 19 points, dramatically undersells its scientific importance. A Nature paper reporting the first confirmed superconducting monolayer cuprate with a single CuO2 plane. This is a copper oxide superconductor reduced to literally one atomic layer, and it's showing superconducting behavior at temperatures that are remarkable for that geometry.
The significance here is that one of the major open questions in high-temperature superconductivity is understanding the minimum structural unit required for the phenomenon. By getting superconductivity in a single CuO2 plane, this work isolates the physics in a way that wasn't possible with bulk materials. The comment thread is tiny, only 4 comments, but they're from people who clearly know this field. And the consensus seems to be that this is genuine progress on understanding the mechanism, not just an engineering curiosity.
The broader applied implication, room temperature superconductors for power transmission, computing, and magnetic levitation, remains years or decades away. But understanding why cuprates superconduct is a prerequisite for engineering better ones, and this is a meaningful piece of that puzzle.
I also want to briefly flag the at-home tick test for Lyme disease story, which got 263 points. The Smithsonian piece covers a new test that lets you check a tick for Borrelia burgdorferi infection before the results of that exposure become visible through clinical symptoms. The standard Lyme diagnosis window, where you have to wait for a rash or early symptoms before treatment is indicated, has always been a problem because not everyone develops the characteristic bullseye rash. An at-home test that you can run on the tick itself before it even goes to a lab could genuinely change how early treatment gets initiated.